Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 3rd of April. Today, a $1 trillion boost to the world's economy is agreed by G20 leaders. But is it enough?
We believe that in this new global age, our prosperity is indivisible. We believe that global problems require global solutions. We believe that growth to be sustained must be shared, and that trade must once again become an engine of growth.
Another day, another summit. NATO leaders are meeting in France and Germany.
Top of the agenda is Afghanistan, the biggest challenge that NATO faces, and they're not doing terribly well.
And Birmingham announces plans to build Britain's biggest ever public library.
They want it to be a place where people from all walks of life and all different ethnic groups can come together and understand a kind of shared history and a shared heritage in Birmingham. It's very ambitious.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. On guardian.co.uk.
But first, the headlines and a look at the papers with Bill Overton.
Gordon Brown's $1.1 trillion deal to fix the global economy will come under more scrutiny today as city analysts gauge reaction on the market. The deal saw shares jump in London and New York yesterday, with the FTSE 100 up more than 4%. The aid package has won praise from business leaders as well as anti-poverty campaigners. The Green lobby has criticised it, though, saying it lacks measures to combat climate change. Gordon Brown's hailed the agreement as a coming together of the world, which will speed recovery from the worst recession since 1945. President Obama says the London summit was historic and that the patient is now stabilised and is in good care. As well as the financial injection to the global economy, the summit talks also led to tougher-than-expected measures to tighten financial regulation, including a clampdown on tax havens. There's to be a common approach to dealing with toxic assets that impair the ability of banks to lend. And there was also a shot in the arm for developing nations, giving them more power within the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. The G20 leaders also agreed to re-examine the state of the world at a further summit, probably in New York or East Asia in September. Meanwhile, crowd control tactics used by the police have been condemned as an infringement of the right to demonstrate. Politicians, demonstrators and a former police officer have raised concerns after reports that a peaceful protest in Bishopsgate in the city was broken up aggressively by riot police with batons and dogs. In other news, another summit takes place today, a NATO meeting in France and Germany. European leaders are expected to resist American pressure to join in the Pentagon's military surge in Afghanistan, disappointing Barack Obama. The US president has made the campaign against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda the centrepiece of his new foreign policy. The keenly awaited meeting marks NATO's 60th birthday and also Obama's debut in continental Europe. The summit will also see NATO grow from 26 to 28 members with the admission of Croatia and Albania, but will sidestep the more contentious issue of further enlargement into the former Soviet Union. Royal Bank of Scotland bosses are to be rebuked by shareholders over their pay and pensions at the bank's annual general meeting in Edinburgh. As majority shareholder, the government will register public anger at the pension award to former chief executive Sir Fred Goodwin. Shareholders can vote on the issue, but it's not legally binding, and RBS doesn't have to accept demands for changes. The bank's new bosses now hope to create a firebreak between a disastrous recent past and their plans to help the Royal Bank back into profit. Now let's take a look at the papers, and of course they're all focusing on the outcome of the G20 summit. Both The Guardian and The Mail proclaim Brown's new world order. The Daily Telegraph says the fight back starts here, and The Express says we're now on the way out of the economic despair which has characterised the past few months. Rays of hope at long last is the headline there. The Times goes with The London United, with a photo of Barack Obama giving a thumbs up with his arm around Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. But the paper also looks ahead to the NATO summit, pointing out that it's not all harmony and that leaders are divided over what to do in Afghanistan. The Red Tops take a more light-hearted approach. Gee whiz is the simple headline in The Mirror, while The Sun has mocked up a photograph of Gordon Brown to look like Austin Powers with a speech bubble declaring, "And to save the world, I demand $1 trillion. Inside, the papers all devote column inches to whether the aid package will work. The downturn will go on, but this should restore confidence, says Hamish McRae in The Independent, while The Guardian reports that Sarkozy claims key role in ending financial madness. There's also reaction from the paper's environmental correspondent, George Monbiot, who says saving the planet is an afterthought, highlighting concerns that the health of the planet's ecosystem is being sacrificed at the summit. Elsewhere, The Mail reports on a victory for villagers at Broughton in Buckinghamshire who didn't want to appear on Google's new Street View website. when they saw the cart with a camera turn up to take photos. They put up a human shield to stop it. And finally, The Sun declares Madge's unfit mother, reporting that Madonna's adoption plans are in disarray after she fell off her treadmill and twisted her ankle at her luxury lodge in Malawi. The paper says she had the fitness machine specially flown in so she can keep up her strict exercise regime while she goes through the process of adopting another African baby. More news and comments throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The world's economy is to receive a $1 trillion boost after the leaders of the most powerful nations met at the G20 summit in London yesterday. They agreed to reform the international financial system, bringing hedge funds and credit rating agencies under a global regulatory net, and the OECD is to name and shame tax havens that don't comply with requests for transparency. With the press at London's Excel Centre was Heather Stewart, the Observer's business editor. She says the International Monetary Fund will play a key role.
I think, in a way, we have to be slightly cautious about this $1 trillion figure, because some of this is money that is being given to the IMF as effectively as an insurance policy. The IMF now sees itself, it tells us, as a writer of insurance policies. And Mexico, for example, has just taken a loan from the IMF, a $30 billion loan from the IMF, but only on the basis that it can have the money if it needs it, if the crisis worsens. So a lot of this money is actually not being pumped out into the economy in the sense of being given to people to spend on goods and services in a sort of fiscal stimulus sort of way. A lot of it is being set aside just in case there are worse emergencies, because what ministers are really worried about here is that far more countries will have to join those, such as the Ukraine, that have already been forced to borrow from the IMF because their government finances have been left in a terrible state by the credit crunch.
Anti-poverty groups have expressed concern about the rising power of the IMF. What will this mean in practice?
It's very interesting that this summit has ended up with a very strong boost to the IMF's power, because one of the things the Prime Minister said this afternoon was that this was an end to the Washington Consensus, which is the sort of set of policies promulgated really by the IMF about liberalising markets, freeing up financial institutions and so on, which many see is at the heart of this crisis. And actually, what NGOs are worried about is that by strengthening the IMF hugely, by allocating large sums of new resources to it, actually the risk is that these policies will start riding high again. And certainly the IMF does impose very strict conditions on countries it loans money to, which has been a great concern in the past.
What effect will the G20 communique have on Britain's economy?
Gordon Brown was asked this question at the press conference, and he certainly said that he hopes that because we're all our fortunes are bound together, because this is a global economy now, he hopes that by stimulating demand all around the world at the same time, you help to generate demand for British goods and exports and so on, and some of the money ends up finding its way back home. And that because we're all so interconnected, it's impossible to sit in London trying to kickstart the UK economy if no one else is doing anything abroad. And so he's hoping that with all of us working together, the impact of things like fiscal stimulus policies will be much stronger.
What's your assessment of that?
He's right that it's important to work together, though one might also fear that he has spent an awful lot of time in recent months travelling around the world trying to boost political support for these sorts of measures, for reforms of the financial markets and re-regulation, for example. And these are very important measures, but one might argue that there are also crucial issues to be faced at home, such as the size of our deficit, our spending plans, what should be done in next month's budget, and so on.
And how significant, Heather, are these steps that have been taken towards regulating the international financial system?
Well, actually, I think that's a very significant area of what's been agreed today, because until quite recently, global regulation or any sort of international oversight of financial markets was anathema, really, to the US and to the UK. You know, we saw the Citi as independent and quite capable of looking after itself, thank you very much. And what's been agreed today is there's an existing body called the Financial Stability Forum, which consists of central banks and finance ministries and national regulators like our FSA. And at the moment, it's a rather informal body, almost like a think tank. The plan is to beef this up, give it a new title, a Financial Stability Board, and give it a much stronger role. And the FSF today has itself has said some of the things it plans to do, including taking a good look at the pay policies of bankers right around the world, which, again, is something that until quite recently would have seemed quite surprising. And hedge funds are also going to find themselves coming under much closer scrutiny than they have done over the last few years.
Heather Stewart. Well, the G20 summit was Gordon Brown's idea. He invited the world's most powerful leaders to London in an attempt to secure a coordinated attempt to boost the global economy. The Prime Minister also hoped the summit would revive his political fortunes. Nicholas Watt, our chief political correspondent, says the G20 communique was a good result for Gordon Brown.
Let's look at this. He stood in front of 22 world leaders and came up with a package of measures which was praised lavishly by the man of the moment, obviously being Barack Obama. So yes, for him, he will hope that this will not just be the road to economic recovery, but for him, it'll be the road to political recovery ahead of the general election, which will probably take place in May next year.
He did seem confident and relaxed at the press conference after the summit, thoroughly in command of the situation.
Well, economics is his specialist subject, so if he can't do well on this, then it's going to be pretty tricky for him. Everyone knows that economics is his specialist subject. The big question is whether he can translate this into political success. The Conservatives were up and running pretty quickly, saying that this, what was agreed at the G20 summit, was actually endorsing their position. Yes, Gordon Brown was talking about a $1 trillion boost for the world economy, but the Tories are saying that's not a fiscal stimulus that he believes in. That's fiscal sustainability. That's what we believe in. So there we are. The battle lines are drawn there. But nevertheless, Gordon Brown was standing up in front of 22 world leaders. He's got a pretty substantial agreement, not just on that $1 trillion boost for the world economy, but also big agreement on tax havens. And he would argue that that's pretty substantial.
How did Gordon Brown and the other delegates overcome this apparent rift between Britain and America in favour of a fiscal stimulus on one side and France and Germany and those against on another?
Well, I suppose Gordon Brown would say it's not a rift because all the leaders in the world have agreed that they will do, and this is the key phrasing, whatever is necessary to boost growth. So Britain will say privately, well, the Germans were fantastically rude about a fiscal stimulus in December last year. They described the cut in VAT, that was Britain's great fiscal stimulus, 2.5% cut. They described that as crass Keynesianism. What happened 2 months later? The Germans introduced an €84 billion fiscal stimulus, which is in fact one of the largest fiscal stimulus is in the world. So yes, they may be saying now they can't have a fiscal stimulus, but in a few months' time, perhaps even after the German general election in September, maybe the Germans will step in. So Gordon Brown would say, we haven't given up on that.
This was President Obama's first major international summit. What did you make of him?
Well, Barack Obama's big moment really came yesterday when he held that hour-long press conference with Gordon Brown in the Locarno room in the Foreign Office. There was a feeling when he met Gordon Brown in the White House last month that perhaps he was not exactly overly enthusiastic. Gordon Brown went to great lengths to give him a fantastic present symbolizing the special relationship between Britain and the United States. And Barack Obama gave him a DVD collection. So he lavished praise on Gordon Brown. He talked about how marvellous the Queen was. And indeed, he found 30 minutes to speak to and meet David Cameron, the leader of the Conservative Party. So his sort of big moment in the limelight was yesterday. But Barack Obama did play a significant role in the summit because the real division turned out to be not so much between Britain and Germany and France on over fiscal stimulus. It was between France and China over tax havens, because China wants to protect Hong Kong and Macau. That was all getting a bit tricky. Barack Obama, in his very genial way, wandered into the summit and basically said to Hu Jintao, the president of China, and Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France, come on, guys, let's get this into perspective. And right up until the end of the summit, until 5 minutes before the end of the summit, Nicolas Sarkozy was still pushing hard, still trying to get the French wording in there on tax havens, and Barack Obama intervened and said, come on, guys, this is an unprecedented moment. And then he said, this is a brilliant example of multilateralism at its best, and it's great for a young United States president to be witnessing that. And at that, Gordon Brown said, I think we're in agreement. and then the leaders fanned out to brief the world.
Nicholas Watt, and there's full coverage of G20 at guardian.co.uk/G20. And from midday today, you can listen to a special edition of our Politics Weekly podcast focusing on G20 with analysis from The Guardian's panel of experts, including Jonathan Friedland and Larry Elliott. That's at guardian.co.uk/audio. Also on The Guardian's website today, John Henley on the contents of the Queen's new iPod. She was given it by Barack Obama. Guardian.co.uk/G2. Marina Hyde considers the phenomenon of the celebrity protester at guardian.co.uk/lostinshowbiz. And Stephen Moss looks at the demise of regional media. guardian.co.uk/media. After the G20 summit ended yesterday, Barack Obama and Gordon Brown were among the leaders and thousands of demonstrators heading for another international get-together. This time it's NATO that's holding the summit, hosted by the French President Nicolas Sarkozy and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Our Europe editor Ian Traynor is in Strasbourg.
Well, first of all, they're having a 60th birthday bash. It's 60 years since NATO was founded in 1949 in Washington. So this one is being hosted jointly by the French and the Germans to mark a couple of big events, i.e. the first time that France has been reintegrated into NATO's command structure since the 1960s, when President de Gaulle went into a huff and kicked the alliance out of its Paris headquarters ever since it's been based in Belgium. So that's one thing on the French side. And then in Baden-Baden, the old spa town across the River Rhine in Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel will be hosting President Obama this morning for the first time in continental Europe, so to speak. So that will be quite a big event, seeing Obama. Of course, Obama was in Berlin last year when he was campaigning for the White House, and he attracted 200,000 adoring supporters. This time it's slightly different. Some very hard decisions have to be made. Top of the agenda is Afghanistan, the biggest challenge that NATO faces, and they're not doing terribly well. The Obama administration has just come out with this policy strategy review on Afghanistan. Would very much like to see the Europeans stepping up to the plate and joining them in the so-called military surge to pour thousands more troops into Afghanistan in the short term. And the Europeans are balking and basically saying thanks, but no thanks. And let's see how else we can help you. So that's top of the agenda.
NATO's also reaching out to Iran and Russia for help in rebuilding Afghanistan and defeating the Taliban. What steps is it able to take down that road?
Well, that's very much an American initiative. I mean, NATO itself can play a supporting role here. Everything depends on the White House, of course. In London, with the first meeting between Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, the Russian president, we saw some progress on arms control and the beginning of a better relationship between the Americans and the Russians. Pressing the reset button, as Joe Biden, the American vice president, puts it. And again, also earlier this week in The Hague, and another big American ordered conference in Afghanistan, you had the Iranians taking part, talking to the Americans for the first time, and the first time they'd been invited there by Hillary Clinton, American Secretary of State. So obviously there are several moves afoot in different directions here. But as I say, for NATO, it's very much a backstage role here to the new American leadership.
Ian Traynor. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Kevin McCarra on Alan Shearer's takeover at Newcastle United.
Only 8 games left. If they do go down, all he's done is failed to pull them out of a terrible tailspin.
But first, Britain's biggest ever public library is to be built in Birmingham. The Library of Birmingham, that's what they're calling it, will tower over Centenary Square and cost £193 million. And that includes £159 million from council taxpayers. The Guardian's Robert Booth says the council hopes it'll be able to accommodate more than 3 million visitors a year.
The City Council intended it to be a major new public icon, really, in the centre of Birmingham city centre. And so what they've decided to do is hire an avant-garde firm of architects called Mekanu, who are based in Delft in the Netherlands, to come up with something that will really catch the eye and rival some of the other big civic buildings that Birmingham's quite famous for. So what they've produced is something that will tower over Centenary Square. It's over several stories, and it appears to be clad in a kind of metal filigree material, which is intended somehow to echo the arts and crafts heritage of Birmingham, but it looks a little bit like the pattern you might see on a doily.
And about 75% of this cost of this library is going to be funded by the taxpayer. What do the council hope to get out of it?
Well, the council has said that it's very keen to regenerate Birmingham city centre using the library. So that clearly there's a strong interest in using the library not as just as a place for books and information, but as some kind of anchor to draw people into the city centre. One of the officials I spoke to, I said, why the library now? And they said, well, I think we've done the museums. And this seems to be a trend across the country, which is, you know, over the last decade or so, a lot of big museums have been built or refurbished in city centres on the basis that they can instigate a so-called urban renaissance. And now people are looking at using libraries to do the same thing. That's not the only thing they're trying to do, of course. They're quite keen to allow it to fulfil their social inclusion agendas, which the council in Birmingham are very keen on. And so they want it to be a place where people from all walks of life and all different ethnic groups can come together and understand a kind of shared history and a shared heritage in Birmingham. It's very ambitious.
Do people agree on what libraries such as this should be used for?
Well, no. I mean, you can tell from everything that I've just said, very little of it was about books and reading. And when I talked to the library bosses about it, that was the way they talked about their ambitions for it. There are plenty of library campaigners in the country who are very keen that libraries should be doing much more about books and magazines, and that by having the widest possible selection of that material, including foreign materials as well, they will do the job already by dint of doing that, of achieving social inclusion and so on. Whereas others seem to think that they're more instruments of government policy in some way, and using libraries to pursue those kind of agendas. So the role of the library at the moment does seem to be slightly fraught. There's a bit of a tug of war going on over it.
Libraries are free, of course, for users. Are more people using libraries now that we're sliding into economic recession?
Well, certainly that's what the Museums, Libraries and Archives organisation, which is a government quango, told me. Over the last 5 or so years, the statistics show a steady decline in the number of people visiting libraries and the number of books being issued by libraries. But now they're saying that, having spoken to some of the bigger facilities around the country over the last 8 months or so, since last summer when the recession really started to, or at least the credit crunch started to bite and we moved into recession, there's been an increase of about 10 to 15% in footfall, in people coming into libraries. The reason behind that seems to be people using them for the very practical chores of going on the internet to look for jobs and taking out books which are about retraining and skills.
Now, why are so many local libraries closing? If libraries are such a good thing and they have this effect on regenerating communities and so on, why are we seeing places such as the Wirral, which tomorrow is closing down 11 libraries? Why is that happening?
Well, they start closing down the libraries tomorrow. I think 3 of them shut tomorrow and then more of them over the next couple of months. And that policy seems to be an attempt to save some money to some extent for the local authority, but also they seem to believe that some of these libraries are simply too small really to do the job. They don't have sufficient range of materials, so they're intending to put the facilities together and have larger libraries, and also have with those libraries other council services and other kind of civic facilities that can be all bound together, so you have a kind of one stop shop. That certainly seems to be the trend.
Robert Booth. Alan Shearer is the new manager of Newcastle United. At a press conference yesterday, Shearer said he was really excited at the prospect.
Seen all the players and spoke to them, spoke to all the staff, and the training was superb. I think they've set a standard now this morning that that we want them to keep to, and I said to them after training that if you keep the standard up, keep that determination up, then I think we'll be okay.
But Shearer's contract is only until the end of the season, after he hopes he's helped the club avoid relegation. Our chief football writer is Kevin McCarra.
It's interesting, he's had opportunities in the past. He could have gone into the England squad under Steve McLaren, thought better of it. He could have gone into Newcastle earlier this season as part of the backroom staff, but again, he might have been a kind of fig leaf for newcomers then, like Joe Kinnear. He's quite cunning. The situation now is that he's in sole charge, and also, should he fail, it's not his fault, because it's only 8 games left. If they do go down, all he's done is failed to pull them out of a terrible tailspin.
Will he stay on next season if they go down?
I find that hard to imagine. That would be a kind of quagmire in a way. How much money will there be? The owner, Mike Ashley, has lost a lot of money already in the sense that he's bought the club and found his investment is now worth less than it was. So I think there's rocky times ahead unless he can keep them up.
And the big question, Kevin, is whether they can keep him up. I mean, the Comments Is Free part of Guardian's website has been running a poll and they're roughly two-thirds believe that he has no chance of avoiding relegation, whereas a third remain optimistic. What do you think?
I think it's absurd saying no chance, because they're only 2 points off safety. But they have, in my view, quite a difficult programme ahead of them, with Chelsea coming on Saturday. The thing you have to bear in mind, though, is that people think Alan Shearer is boring. Well, I don't agree with this. I think he was a very exciting player at his best. And also, he has got charisma in the eyes of the Geordie nation. And there will really be a tremendous atmosphere at the remaining home games. And I guess the club are hoping that it's going to pay off in terms of points.
And will he have the full support of the chairman?
Well, he has. I mean, but obviously he can't buy any players at the moment, so talk is cheap. I mean, you can have the full support as long as you don't ask for access to his bank account.
Kevin McCarra, Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.